The Black Hills Forest is central to life in our region. How are we taking care of it? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, August 13th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, our SDPB spotlight on the National Forest. Today, we look at case number one. It's the first time the federal government, charged with protecting and preserving the forest, sold timber to private industry after blocking that industry from plundering natural resources for profit. We talk with Bill Coburn. Richard Tubbles joins us from SDPB's studio at Red Cloud. We consider the annual Duck Stamp Art Competition and why artists follow the fowl to South Dakota. Laura Rohde has that story. Plus, Moment in Sound with members of the band Hudek. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first.
With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. Firefighters have contained a wildfire which burned southwest of Sturgis. The U.S. Forest Service says crews will continue to patrol and mop up following containments from the Kirk Hill fire. Smoke is expected to be present for the next several days. The fire burned approximately 80 acres. No structures were lost in the fire. The 81st Sturgis Motorcycle Rally vehicle count is over 370,000. The Department of Transportation places rubber tubes across roads that count every car driving over them. The department uses the data to determine the size of the rally. Mike Carlson is the Rapid City Engineer for the South Dakota Department of Transportation. He says now the main concern for the rally is controlling traffic.
So that's our concern right now is those people that are leaving, those that are coming in, and those that are still riding their bikes, make sure that mix of traffic, everything still flows as well as it can, and so we don't have any serious accidents.
This year's traffic count is higher than last year's, but it trails the 75th rally when more than 500,000 vehicles were counted. Rapid City's back-to-school COVID mitigation plan is in limbo, and school is less than 2 weeks away. School officials made the plan last spring before a board election. Now the board's new leader and new members say the plan needs to change. Jacqueline Severin has the story for SDPB.
The plan does not require masks or vaccinations for its students or staff. It does, however, have several other mitigation procedures. One protocol requires unvaccinated students and staff to quarantine if they show symptoms or have been exposed to COVID-19. Students and staff who are vaccinated do not have to quarantine. School Board President Kate Thomas opposes quarantining. She says an executive order from Governor Kristi Noem prevents schools from requiring proof of an individual's COVID-19 vaccination status.
Here we have unvaccinated students and staff who are identified as close contacts will be required to quarantine. Well, how do you know if you're not allowed to ask them? There should be no quarantine.
The actual language in Noem's executive order forbids local governments from requiring vaccine passports to receive a benefit, a license, or do business with the government. Thomas also says it's not the job of school nurses to do contact tracing or provide COVID-19 testing. Katie Urban is the communications manager for the Rapid City area schools. She says quarantining and contact tracing helped keep COVID cases to a minimum last school year, and administrators want to continue with those measures. She says the Rapid City school system wants to keep students and staff safe.
These are really tough issues, and ultimately it's really tough to make everyone happy. So we just are really are trying to just put some common sense measures in place, and hopefully that's something that everyone can agree on.
The school board will vote on the back-to-school plan at their next meeting on August 23rd. That's one day before the start of school. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jacqueline Severin.
Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken wants to cap the number of medical marijuana dispensaries in the city at 5. South Dakota voters legalized medical marijuana last November. Tenhaken says he wants to start small and learn from marijuana's impact on the community. He says the city could allow more dispensaries in the future. Tenhaken will introduce his plan to the Sioux Falls City Council on Tuesday. A final vote is scheduled for September 7th. Today, there'll be a high of 80 across the state and lows will be in the 60s to 50s. Tomorrow, there's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Yesterday, we talked with Dr. Susan Hoover, an infectious disease specialist at Sanford Health, and we asked Hoover about the HIV treatment PrEP and new guidance from the Biden administration relevant for patients, doctors, and insurers. Well, today, we're going to focus on what we know about prevalence of South Dakota residents with HIV and or AIDS. Joining us for that conversation, we have Cassie Deffenbaugh, an administrator in the Office of Disease Prevention Services with the South Dakota Department of Health. Welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
What do we know about South Dakotans living with HIV or AIDS? What sort of things does the Department of Health track?
So HIV is a reportable disease nationally, and that's no different in South Dakota. So we are able to do surveillance on HIV through our normal reporting methods. So providers and laboratories across the state and nationally are responsible for reporting that. So we do know that HIV is largely centered around our more populated areas in the state. In 2020, we had approximately 700 South Dakotans living with HIV in South Dakota, which is about 0.07% of the population. And to compare, in the U.S., we had about 1.2 million Americans living with HIV in the U.S. population, which is about 0.3% of the population. We do know that most South Dakotans living with HIV are between the ages of 25 and 64, with about 48% of those making up the ages of 25 to 39-year-olds and 72% being male.
There are some in the report from the Department of Health notes about racial and ethnic disparities in the data. What can you tell me about that?
You are correct. We do know that minorities are disproportionately affected by HIV in South Dakota. For instance, our Black or African American population make up about 2.3% of South Dakota's population, but about 24% of HIV cases. Native Americans and American Indians make up about 9% of South Dakota's population, but are 17% of those cases. So certainly some disparities there that we work on lessening and decreasing, whether it's barriers to access to care or getting people into treatment and care for all South Dakotans.
So how likely is it for someone who is diagnosed with HIV to also be diagnosed with AIDS, and how does that intersect with early testing?
Early testing is critical to identifying someone who has HIV so it does not progress into AIDS. Prevention is really key. We do know that there are certain individuals who are at higher risk for acquiring HIV. If someone is testing late, that means that they are essentially diagnosed with AIDS within 12 months of their initial HIV diagnosis. So that's what we consider a late tester. And individuals who are diagnosed early on with HIV are essentially able to get on treatment sooner, get their viral suppression attained, and essentially not be able to transmit the virus to sexual partners.
All right. For a lot of parents, that idea of viral suppression is new. Parents who grew up and were teenagers or, you know, young adults during the AIDS outbreak in the 80s. Tell us a little bit about viral suppression and how it changes the spread of the disease. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So for a little bit of history, our first HIV case was diagnosed in 1980. HIV treatments were then introduced in about 1987, and that was those initial HIV treatments. We do know that our earliest death rates that we had were published in 1987 at about 11.5 deaths per 100,000 in the United States, with our highest death rate being in 1995 at 32.6 deaths per 100,000. And fortunately, in 1997, we had what's called highly active antiretroviral therapy introduced into HIV care, which really became the new standard and decreased those death rates down to, in 2018, 3.1 per 100,000. And when we're talking about viral suppression, that is the ability for the virus then to spread to others. So 200 copies per ml in very technical language. Yeah. If we are below that, then that individual has virtually or essentially no ability to transmit that virus to a sexual partner. So it really is critical for our individuals living with HIV to get into care, in with their providers, adherent to medication, and live a long, healthy life with HIV. It really has become a more chronic and manageable condition that essentially what happens is if someone is adherent to medications, they can live the life of someone who is not living with HIV and really just have a long, healthy life as their counterparts who are not living with HIV.
All right. One last thing. We're also seeing a resurgence of syphilis in the state, as well as some high numbers for chlamydia and gonorrhea infections. Tell me a little bit about the role of the Department of Health in tracking those numbers and in education, prevention, mitigation. What do you want to say about those other sexually transmitted diseases?
Thank you for asking that, Lori. We are seeing a resurgence, and so it is very important to remain vigilant. For HIV specifically, everyone should be tested at least once in their life between the ages of 13 and 64. And if you're at high risk, even more regular. We do know that if you test positive for other diseases like chlamydia, gonorrhea, or syphilis, the more you test positive for those diseases, the more at risk you are later on in life or later on to acquiring HIV. Syphilis is increasing. We want to make sure that one thing I want to put out there is please make sure you're going in for prenatal care so we can prevent congenital syphilis. We want to prevent any babies from having congenital syphilis or any impact of syphilis from their mother during pregnancy. We also just want people to know that there are certain risk factors out there for individual syphilis. We want people to make sure that they're engaging in consistent condom use, that if they are having multiple partners, being getting tested regularly. For individuals that are sharing or doing injection drug use, we want those individuals to be smart and get in for testing regularly. We at the Department of Health are working with partners across the state to increase awareness around syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases and just create more testing opportunities. We are working with multiple partners to engage in different testing events and educational opportunities, providing some education to providers. We at the Department of Health work these cases and identify partners or individuals who are at risk who would benefit from testing. So a lot of different activities in the Department of Health, and we continue to combat that increase in sexually transmitted diseases.
Cassie Deffenbaugh is an administrator in the Office of Disease Prevention Services with the South Dakota Department of Health, and we've got links to the Department of Health resources on today's show notes. That's all on our website at sdpb.org/news. Cassie, welcome, and thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Ahead on the program, SDPB's Richard Tubels joins us from the SDPB studios at Red Cloud. We'll talk with Richard and Michael Tubels about art, family, and community. You're listening to The Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, some of the most horrific crimes in history.
Where scientists are committing these dastardly deeds in the name of science.
And Margaret Atwood on the role of science.
A tool for expressing and perfecting human desires, and sometimes it's a tool for counteracting human fears.
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding by Art South Dakota, a catalyst for creative and artistic expression in communities and schools throughout South Dakota. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artsouthdakota.org.
There's a night 50 years ago that Nina Fuller still can't understand. If you ask her what she thinks she should have done, she knows the answer.
I walk out and I get in my car and I drive home. Definitely. But that's not what I did.
Why our own behavior can be mystifying, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Some days we don't hear the big news until someone tells us. NPR keeps you connected to the world so you find out first. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this member station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The disruption of the pandemic hit the arts community and economy hard. Racing Magpie was established in Rapid City to give local Native American artists a place to create art and collaborate. Owners Mary Bordeaux and Peter Strong had to shut their doors due to the pandemic and in order to protect the safety of their artists. Well, today we once again connect with SDPB's Red Cloud Studio with our very own Richard Tubels. And today Richard has brought a special guest into the studio space. Richard, I understand Racing Magpie has reestablished at a new location.
Hello, Laurie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, same. Appreciate it. Racing Magpie, you know, they've been a great venue for all things art, you know, specifically Native American art. And, you know, that's kind of been their focal point for their business. And my relative, my cousin Mike, is here with me right now, Michael Tubels. And he was commissioned to do a mural at their new location.
Yeah, welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you?
Good, thank you, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about this new venture and about the mural. This was a residency program with community input, yeah?
Yeah, I was strongly encouraged by Peter Strong, Racing Magpie, to apply. And once I got it, we kind of just hit the ground running, planning and sketch work. And it took us about a month with the mural. It's like 20 foot by 40 foot, around there.
Wow.
So it was a pretty massive mural.
That's not an easy artistic task, but it's also a part of a community conversation. What, in the planning of this, what stands out to you, Michael, as what you were hearing from others and what was kind of coming into your mind as an artist that ended up influencing the final result?
Sure, yeah. Well, going into it, I had my Pajuta Press in mind, which is a group of revolving artists that work doing all sorts of different art projects. So when we went into it, it was an outreach to community. We had two meetings, one virtual and one in person, and it was very much community informed, which was new to me to approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard, what's interesting that we're joining you both from the Red Cloud Studio. This is the second time Richard and I have gone live and made this connection. Hmm. Michael, would you chip in on this idea of the significance of Red Cloud as it intersects with the arts?
Well, I think when Rick told me about the new studio here opening up, I immediately got excited because, you know, like all the stories that would come from here in the reservation, and even maybe possibly working with the students here in journalists classes is profound. So, yeah.
Rick, that's new for me. I need to ask Michael some more stories that I didn't know. Somebody calls you Rick, make a note. Tell me a little bit about what it means to be back in the Red Cloud Studio for you.
Well, my sisters call me Ricky, so it's...
Okay. Also
there's
noted.
A lot going on there. But
telling on it.
You know, I'm excited to be here in Red Cloud. You know, the the owners of Racing Magpie, Mary Bordeaux and her husband Peter Strong, you know, they spent many years here running the Heritage Museum and curating the annual Red Cloud Art Show.
Mm-hmm. Mike, you come from this family of artists and storytellers. You've been on the program before playing music. And I just want to know, how do you come into your own as an artist? What can you tell me about that?
I think as an artist, I try to be in a state of becoming. And I think as an artist, that's the role that we should all play, you know, not even artists, but even beyond, you know, just like a human thing, right? Mm-hmm. Always in the state of becoming. So that means always learning and unlearning, education, opening your ears up, community. So that was a huge undertaking in itself with the mural, with that sort of mindset.
Yeah. Do you think, Michael, that the pandemic is a wound of some sort? That, like, how much is what people endured during the pandemic, which is still, you know, our
ongoing.
Numbers are surging again, so this is not a completed story. How does that influence things, this sort of damage that was done during this time? We can't just ignore it, brush it off, and move on.
No, I mean, I know that the mural, the ask of the mural was to be more specific around COVID-19 issues that affected us through the year. And when I was thinking about it more with talking with other folks and thinking about it more deeply, I realized that a lot of the root issues actually go beyond the pandemic, really, around like structures, systems set up here. And we're just not ready for a pandemic, right? I mean, that this is just the realities we're living in. Yeah. So keeping that in mind, I wanted to kind of talk to Indigenous people with the mural, you know what I mean? Like, so for their eyes, right? So even with that simple sort of topic, approaching it was very difficult and very fruitful, actually.
Yeah. Michael Tubbles and Richard Tubbles from the SDPB Red Cloud Studio. Richard, I'm going to give you last word because you're back in this space. You're looking at places like Racing Magpie, run by Mary and Peter, and these ongoing efforts. As we talk about the damage and the wounds, we also have to talk about the people who are building that resiliency. Wrap us up here, Richard, if you would.
Yeah, so, you know, like, one of my biggest things is looking forward to utilizing the space more so.
Yeah.
And that has to do a lot with, you know, working with the students here and being able to give them that idea for the same compassion that I share when it comes to storytelling. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, written word, prose, or even, you know, a painting, but just to get them that compassion for storytelling, and that's kind of the biggest thing that I want to bring here.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori.
Up next, the titans of industrialization were plundering the Black Hills after the discovery of gold by members of the Custer Expedition. We're going to talk about what the history is of case number one, the first timber sale in the nation, and efforts to save the forest that continue today. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week in This American Life, Shelley was waiting tables in Phoenix during the pandemic, trying her hardest not to get COVID.
I would have people ask me, like, pull down your mask, I want to see how much to tip you.
Pull down your mask, I want to see how much to tip you?
Yes.
Wow.
They would want to see how pretty I was before they tipped me.
What it's really been like to be an essential worker this week.
Listen Saturday morning at 11 Central, 10 Mountain.
Program funding by Midco Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
Tracy Ellis Ross says she's happy to see Hollywood start to recognize and embrace Black women, but...
This is not new. Black girl magic might be a new term, but it's an old experience.
Like, exactly.
We've been here being incredible forever.
Yeah.
Telling our stories, being our stories, so that's not new.
Tracy Ellis Ross on Owning Her Narrative, next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Bangs McCullen Law Firm. From humble beginnings in the Dakota Territory over 130 years ago, now a full-service firm with offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. There for you then, here for you now. BangsMcCullen.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month, the SDPB spotlight shines on the Black Hills National Forest. Today, we're going to cover a little history by taking you back to case number one. This is the first sale of timber from a nationally protected forest by the federal government, charged with protecting and preserving the forest, to a private business. That business was the Homestake Mining Company. And mining officials didn't have much of a choice about the sale. The federal government had officially put a halt to the plundering of the forest by private industry. Bill Coburn is our guest for the day. He's going to lay out that history for you. Then we'll shift to the present day and the present debate about how much timber to cut from the current Black Hills National Forest. You'll also hear in this interview, he'll mention the former chief deputy of the U.S. Forest Service, Jim Furnish. Well, we talked with Jim Furnish earlier on In the Moment. You can hear from him by heading to our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Here is Bill Coburn. He is a South Dakota forestry consultant with 50 years in the industry. He is a fellow with the Society of American Foresters.
After gold was discovered, you know, we had anywhere from 20 to 50,000 people descend into the Black Hills in the mid-1870s. And they were using wood for a lot of different things. And they pretty much, between 1876 and about the mid-1890s, late, you know, 1897, they figured over a billion board feet of timber was harvested out of the Black Hills. There's a lot of concern in the 1890s about deforestation, rampant logging. There wasn't any coal in the Black Hills, so a lot of these smelters that were being run to smelt gold down and ore were using wood. And so wood was being cut not only for timbers in the mines, but also railroad ties and fuel. And the smelters used probably the most of the timber to basically smelt the ore down to where they could get the gold out. And so in 1897, the president of the United States declared the non-patented lands of the Black Hills as a forest reserve, and that was supposed to put all these areas offline for being mined or logged or anything. Well, it created quite a furor. And so between 1897 and 1898, there was an act passed by the U.S. Congress called the Organic Act, and it basically allowed the forest reserves and the Department of Interior to sell timber off of these federal reserves. And that's where the case number one came into being down by NEMO. Gifford Pinchot, who was working as an advisor to the Department of Interior, helped put this timber sale together, and they got it sold to Homestake Mining Company. It was for about 15 million board feet, and that was the beginning of timber sales for the National Forest. And then in about 1905, the forest reserves became the National Forest, and we ended up with the Black Hills National Forest.
Is all happening in the context of the Fort Laramie Treaty and also thinking about who inhabits this land.
Yeah.
So now take me back a little bit before timber sale number one and tell me how that's all intersecting.
Well, it was just the, you know, if you look at the pictures and you know what was kind of happening, it was first come, first served in the Black Hills for your mining claims, for the timber, and there weren't any federal controls or concerns about timber cutting. And so, you know, the mines were after all this much timber as they could get. Like I said, there was over a billion board feet of timber estimated to be harvested in the Black Hills. And in fact, in the Northern Hills, in the 1870s, in the 1880s, they estimated over 50 sawmills, most of them steam driven, just in the Northern Hills working.
Wow.
And then Homestake was by far the largest user of timber. And there were several legislations that were passed to make it easy for mining companies to claim timberlands. Those were all pretty much probably abused to the really highest degree. And, you know, all the way into the early 1890s, when the reserves were created, there was a lot of concern by people, including people like Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot and John Muir and a whole bunch of different people of all persuasions, that the forests in the West were getting devastated by the settlement and the industrialization of the West.
And that was,
and so that's where the forest reserves started.
Yeah, that was a scientifically astute. They were correct about that. If there hadn't been a correction, we would have no forest.
Actually, pretty interesting, because the National Academy of Sciences at that point in time appointed a group of people to come in and evaluate the national forests. And the one of those folks who came to the Black Hills was John Muir, who is the first. Basically, he started the Sierra Club and basically protected Yosemite Park. He actually came in on a train into Rapid City. Then they took a wagon or a stagecoach to Sylvan Lake Lodge and stayed there. And they made a bunch of, recommendations about the making the Black Hills Forest Reserve. And that was created in, 1897.
Huh.
And Gifford Pinchot was the first chief for the Bureau of Forestry, which was became underneath the Department of Interior. And then he became the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service as the Department of Interior gradually moved or changed to the Department of Ag under Teddy Roosevelt's charge.
Are there other high points historically that are really important to understand how this has evolved?
There's quite a bit of wood being harvested in the Black Hills in the early 1900s, and those harvest levels kind of tapered off until the right after World War II, and then after that started the increase in volumes. And in from about 1960s, the forest was selling somewhere in that, I don't have the exact numbers, Lori, but what I remember in the, about 50 to 60 million board feet at that point in time in the 1960s. There's a major mountain pine beetle infestation in the northern hills that started, and the Forest Service started to look at, because of that, of the overstocking, the Forest Service started to look at the growth of the forest, estimated growth versus the harvest levels, and figured out that they were not harvesting near enough timber. And so they went out and solicited companies to come in and build sawmills to increase the use of the timber. And in the 1970s all the way through the early 1990s, the timber sale program jumped up to anywhere from 100 to 140 million board feet a year during that period of time. So, about a 20-year period, the timber sale program was really active, and that would probably, in my opinion, be the golden years of the forest product industry. There were more mills harvesting more timber at that point in time than any time in history. And, interesting enough, even during that period, the growth on the national forest was increasing. We went from 5 billion board feet inventory in the 1960s to 6 billion board feet in the late 1990s, in spite of the fact that by the year 2000, 6 billion board feet had been taken off the national forest. So there was a lot of timber being harvested, yet the growth of the forest was still outpacing what the harvest levels and what the mortality was. And anybody who was here in the 2000s know that the Black Hills was way overstocked with trees, and we're worried about the age classes, because 70% of the forest was 100 to 120 years old or older. We called it a wall of wood, and we needed better balance of age classes, and everybody thought we better at least keep the volumes being sold. What happened in the mid-90s, early 2000s, the volumes dropped off. Not increased, they dropped off. They dropped anywhere from, there was one year, there was less than a million board feet sold in 2000. And probably from the late 1990s to the early 2000s, it probably averaged anywhere from that minimal amount to about 50 million board feet.
What was that decision based on?
Well, that gets back to a gentleman that just came here, the ex-deputy chief, Jim Furnish. He was in the middle of that. He didn't like to harvest timber, and he was behind the remanding of the Black Hills National Forest Plan back to the forest to do a bunch more work, and that slowed the ability of the Black Hills to sell timber.
So he said it was time to look at the forest in a broader way, from aesthetic reasons, tourist reasons, carbon capture, all those kinds of things were pushing this change in U.S. forestry, is what he writes in his book. Do you think his science was wrong, was part of a broader conversation that needed to be had? How do you look at the legacy of Jim Furnish?
We were facing, at that point in time, Lori, we were facing a huge overstocking of wood. And you know, it shows, because in 2000, we had a fire, a Jasper fire that burned 83,000 acres. In 2002, we had the Battle Creek fire, 13,000 acres. We had the Grizzly Gulch fire that burned well over 10,000 acres. And we had a lot of other fires that started basically taking out all these heavily stocked stands of forest. And the forest will not stay intact when it's overstocked. And you're going to see it either through natural processes like mountain pine beetle, other types of insects, disease, or fire. It'll start reducing those stocking levels.
What happens next with the current forest? Yeah, I'm going to jump in here real quick and just say, in the interest of time, like, what happens next with the current forest plans and some of the disagreement about reducing the harvest considerably or increasing it? Not everyone agrees on this.
Well, I don't think anybody's looking at, and I know the industry is certainly not looking at trying to increase the volumes. I think right now, forest products industry wants to try to maintain the current infrastructure, and that is after the Hill City Mill closed. They want to try to maintain this infrastructure until the better numbers come out, or more scientifically looked at numbers through a forest plan revision to see what this forest can actually produce. And I got a story for you too, which, you would think the Forest Service would be somewhat unbiased about these things, but they're not. I mean, Jim Furnish was horribly biased against harvesting timber on the national forest. But we had, because of the remanding of the Black Hills National Forest Plan back to the forest, we went through a process called phase one and phase two. And I sat on the phase two committee. And in the spring of 2002, we began looking at this huge amount of overstocked forest on the Black Hills and what to do. One of the Forest Service employees at that time came in and said, well, we need to reduce the timber harvest in the Black Hills to 50 million board feet per year, because that's what the district rangers want. This is that before the mountain pine beetle started really exploding. And, at that point in time, you're wondering, well, what is driving that decision or that desire? And I guess there's some differences of opinion, but what I really don't like right now, what's happening, Laurie, is that there are some who are trying to portray the industry as evil and wanting more and more. I know the industry. I worked in it for, you know, 50 years, basically. I started working for it out of high school, and caring people wanting to make sure what they're doing is sustainable for a long, long time, and they're not looking to over-harvest this forest by any means.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the prescriptions that the Forest Service is using for the current NEPA project called Burl, they've gone to the mats with the Forest Service saying, you know, we don't think these are appropriate. They're too aggressive. There isn't enough regeneration to do the treatments, and taking them to task on that. But the problem is that they also need the timber because the Forest Service isn't selling enough to keep the mills, even the current mill structure, in place right now. So there's a lot of concerns there about trying to keep the current infrastructure in place until we get the revision done.
That's South Dakota forestry consultant Bill Coburn. When he referred to NEPO in that conversation, he's referring to the National Environmental Policy Act. And once again, you can find all our coverage on this topic, including conversations with U.S. Senator John Thune and U.S. Forest Service former Chief Deputy Jim Furnish. It's all on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. Let's take a moment now to consider a humble waterfowl and why it has inspired artists for generations. August 15th is the last day wildlife artists can enter the federal Duck Stamp Art Contest. The painting that wins the contest is featured on the 2022 Duck Stamp. Among the hundreds of entries are at least two from Cottington County artists Adam Grimm and Tim Taylor. Laura Rohde has this story for SDPB with The Close Friends. We'll learn more about the contest that inspired both artists to move to South Dakota.
The Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest results in the painting featured on the stamp. All waterfowl hunters 16 and older are required to buy each year. If you're a wildlife artist and your painting wins, it can be a game changer, explains Watertown artist Tim Taylor.
The Federal Duck Stamp is a very sought after collectible. And when you win, you sell prints, and that's how you earn money, by selling prints and doing remarks on the prints. And then you can sell your original painting.
Off and on for nearly 30 years, Taylor has entered the contest that was launched in 1934 and has raised more than $1.1 billion for conservation of migratory bird habitat. Today, more than 5.2 million acres of migratory bird habitat exists thanks to funds raised by the program. And in a roundabout way, the duck stamp is also responsible for Taylor migrating to South Dakota from New Jersey 3 years ago.
Because they're all here. This is the prairie pothole region, and you got all these little potholes of water everywhere where the ducks come on their migratory routes, and they breed, and you can find them, well, except for West Coast ducks, you can find most of the ducks here.
Taylor was introduced to South Dakota by his friend Adam Grimm. The two artists met during a duck stamp art contest workshop and became fast friends.
Well, even though Adam is quite a bit younger than me, 17 years, he's like my mentor. He's an amazing artist, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him. And so over the years, I would come and stay at his house, and I'd stay for a couple months and paint under his guidance, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him. So eventually, I just decided to drop New Jersey and move here.
Adam Grimm won the federal contest in 1999, just in time to quit art school.
Yeah, you know, when I went to art college, I wasn't real happy there. I kind of butted heads with a lot of the professors because I was doing realistic art of wildlife. They were more pushing the abstract stuff. And my parents wanted me to finish and get a degree from there because they didn't want me to end up living in their basement. And so, you know, I was frustrated because I felt like I'm wasting a lot of time and money on a lot of things that I don't see how this is going to help in the future. And so My parents said the only way they would support me leaving the art college early would be if I were to, say, win the federal duck stamp contest. And later that year, I won. And I'll never forget that day. That was a pretty memorable experience. So I immediately called my parents and told them I was coming back.
Grimm says it was his passion for nature and the outdoors that drew him to become a wildlife artist.
You know, I grew up going, you know, anytime my dad was going hunting or fishing or anything, he would take me along. And in those outings, you know, I would see things that were just incredible. And, you know, you come home and you're trying to tell your mom or your sisters or whoever about what you saw and the experiences. And it's a hard thing sometimes to describe. Well, you know, I would turn then to my art and I would try to sketch out what it was that I had seen and to kind of try to share those moments, I guess, so to speak. But I don't know. I mean, it was, you know, it just seemed like a natural coming together of my two interests.
It was duck hunting that first introduced Grimm to South Dakota and the duck stamp that convinced him to move here.
So the duck stamp program and my love for wildlife art is really the whole reason why we moved to South Dakota. You know, I grew up, like I said, in Ohio, hunting waterfowl in Ohio, which was not that good. And my dad and I came out here with a couple friends on a hunting trip for waterfowl to this area, the northeast part of the state here. And it was so incredible, the waterfowling. I didn't know it was even possible to have it like that really anywhere in the country. So it was just, you know, it was very exciting. And I really fell in love with South Dakota on those trips.
Grimm won the Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest for the second time in 2013, the same year his daughter Madison, then six, won the Junior Duck Stamp Contest.
Well, I never really had any idea what it would mean to win that contest.
Today, Madison is 15. Like her dad, she is a two-time contest winner. She won the Junior Duck Stamp Contest a second time in 2020. The Grimm family lives in Wallace, a community that is home to many wetlands and waterfowl production areas funded by duck stamp dollars. This is a fact that isn't lost on Madison Grimm.
There's so many amazing wetlands around here that are waterfowl production areas and everything, and we've hunted some of them. And it's just really cool to know that, like, winning that and the money that is generated from it goes to help save ducks and give them a good spot to nest and live. And I love, like, going out there and just seeing how many there are.
Because she won the contest in 2020, Madison is not eligible to enter the contest again until 2022. In the meantime, she is cheering on her dad, Adam, and godfather, Tim Taylor. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
For links to artist websites and information on how you can live stream this year's Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest, visit our website at sdpb.org. Ahead on the program, we preview the upcoming Levitt at the Falls concert by bringing music to you. Hudek is next for Moment in Sound. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by TSP. Clients get the most from their facility with the collaborative design team at TSP. Architecture, engineering, interior design, and planning. Making your space and our communities better by design. More at teamtsp.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we're bringing you live music today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Joining me in the studio, Patrick Baker and Tom Valentine, two members of the six-piece band Hudek, which is based in Pierre, and they're playing this weekend at Levitt at the Falls, but they're joined here inside the tiny little space for a moment in sound. Patrick, Tom, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having us, Lori. We appreciate it.
We're going to kick things off with music right away. Enough talking. What do you want to play for us?
This song is called B-Side. It's from the new album, and fittingly, it kicks off side two. I was proud of me.
aisle. You were hiding between the K's and the I's. Then I saw two heads on fire. The cover art hit, the music moved, and I've been searching the rest of my life. And did you know my ears are sonic gold detectors with sonar on? Audio sunken treasures. I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. The best ones never behave. I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. Best ones are here to save. And I was sniffing round you, sticking to the shadows, trying to cover my tracks and scent. I wanted to make sure what the earthquake was for. When your soulful voice had left me rapturously bent. Did you know my heart is a heat-seeking missile with target on a cracked Venus with graveyard whistle? I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. The best ones never behave. I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. The best ones are here to save. For me, there really is no choice. I always pick the least heard voice. And did you know my heart is a heat-seeking missile? Target on a cracked Venus with graveyard whistle. I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. The best ones never behave. I keep playing the B-side. Needle grooves in the contours of the mind, washing the sound waves. Best ones are here to say.
Nice. If you're just tuning in, Hudak is playing Moment in Sound. They're going to switch instruments now. You can see all this excitement on YouTube later as we're filming this as well. I'll tell you a couple things. They are in Sioux Falls for two shows. You can see them tonight at Levitt at the Falls, tomorrow at Last Stop CD Shop in Sioux Falls. That's Saturday in Sioux Falls at Last Stop, which is on a 10th. 10th Street. Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah. All right. Two people here. This is a family operation, though, because you've grown as you've had children, and the kids have changed the sound. Spouses, this is a family operation. Tell me where Hudak comes from, and then we'll get to another song. Where's this name come from?
You know, when we all lived in the Twin Cities, we were writing an album about kind of, and our thought was kind of be around South Dakota and our growing up, and so we thought Hudak, we found, was the state soil of South Dakota. So we thought that was perfect. Yeah.
Who knew? I don't want to say Hudak. I want to shout at everyone like Hudak, like every time.
So we're an educational band.
You're an educational band. All right, let's play again. What are you going to play for us next?
This is actually from that Return to Hudak album, a little South Dakota flavor, and it's called
BB Street Baby.
There you go.
Let me do this real quick. All right.
see my baby, I was driving down on 90, so fast that it was 90 a week. Thinking at Pacwana, how she said, do you wanna come and stay and play with me? When I got into town, she was waiting for me outside. Now she's my Bieber Street and baby, she said, let's go for a ride. And she took me down to the river. She took me down to the river. She took me down to the river and we jumped inside. Gotten dry when we took another drive over to the 18th tee. Before we hit the fairway, her tongue was in my airway. I've never had a better par three. She's got eyes as green as an intern on Wall Street. She's got legs as long as a Ken Burns documentary. And she took me down to the river. She took me down to the river. She took me down to the river and we jumped inside. Great personality. It makes Bro Super Eagle feel meek. Now we've gone to many places and we lived in many cities since we first met that day. But no matter where we go, my girl is always gonna know that she's my Bieber Street baby. And she took me down